Welcome to the Diplomat's podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, an editor at the Diplomat, and I'm joined today by a contributor at the Diplomat, Akhilesh Pillalamari, who contributes to our South Asia and Central Asia coverage. And he's here with me today to discuss topics in South Asian geopolitics. We'll be focusing on the recent collapse of peace talks between India and Pakistan, and after that, we'll actually move into something we haven't discussed on this podcast in a while, which is Indian domestic politics. And it's an interesting time in Indian domestic politics. We'll go into why exactly later in the show, but India's state elections take on a disproportionate level of importance, just given the quirks of how India's political system works. But anyways, Aki, thanks a lot for joining me today. How are you doing today?
I'm very good. How are you today?
Doing great. I'm looking forward to this conversation with you about South Asia's most important bilateral between two nuclear-armed neighbors who can't really seem to get along. Let's begin with, I guess, last week's news when Pakistan's High Commissioner to India, Abdul Basit, told a group of reporters in New Delhi that progress on the India-Pakistan comprehensive bilateral dialogue was effectively suspended. Now, this development followed a long and complicated series of diplomatic overtures and fallouts. Now, I want to provide a very short chronology just to offer our listeners some context, even if they don't follow South Asia as closely as you might, Aki. Now, the best place to start, I think, is last November when the national security advisors of India and Pakistan met in Bangkok. And that followed, actually, the UFA summit, where Nawaz Sharif, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, and Narendra Modi, the Indian Prime Minister, met in Russia at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit and signed a statement that effectively led to a general warming of relations, among other things. So after the November meeting in Bangkok between the two national security advisors, the two foreign ministers met at the Heart of Asia Conference on Afghanistan. That was Sushma Swaraj, the Indian foreign minister, met her Pakistani counterpart, Sartaj Aziz. And finally, the apex of the late 2015 engagement was Christmas Day in Lahore when Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, on his way back to India from a visit to Afghanistan, landed in Pakistan, effectively unannounced, dropping in on Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, and the two leaders were photographed, you know, jovially embracing and optimistically pledging to make 2016 a year for a real serious effort at peace between India and Pakistan, two countries that have, you know, fought four wars since their independence in 1947. Unfortunately, in the first days of the new year, Pakistan-based militants staged an attack on the Indian Air Force base at Pathankot in Punjab. And earlier on this podcast in January, I actually discussed that in great detail, that attack in great detail with Michael Kugelman at the Woodrow Wilson Center. So I'd recommend listeners check out that episode if they're interested. But anyways, this attack came, you know, less than 6 months after a similar attack had taken place in Gurdaspur, also in Punjab. And in both cases, the Indian government blamed Pakistan-based militants. And in the Pathankot case, it blamed Jaish-e-Mohammed, a group led by Masood Azhar that was, among other things, responsible for the attack on the Indian parliament in the early 2000s. Anyways, I don't want to go too much into the weeds on what happened after Pathankot, but Aki, you know, you're a sharp observer of South Asia, and you've written on this for us as well. So, you know, I just wanted to get your sense of where you think India and Pakistan went wrong. I mean, what happened that led to this cancellation of talks? And do you think that this is simply endemic to the India-Pakistan bilateral, or is this something that they can eventually overcome?
Yeah. I think it's extremely unfortunate that the talks are suspended, but to be honest with you, I'm not very surprised because the way things are between India and Pakistan, anytime something seems to be going well, you know something's going to go wrong again, because it's always in the interest of the Pakistani military to torpedo any talks or any improvement in relations between India and Pakistan. So I think Nawaz Sharif is actually one of the most pro-India prime ministers Pakistan has ever had. He wants to improve economic ties with India. He wants to focus his country down the path, take down the path of commerce and development rather than security issues. But unfortunately, this is not the case. Several times he's tried to reach out to India, and several times when it seems like India and Pakistan are making improvements again, something happens. And there's something that happens. It's not just some random thing that happens. It's not just a random attack or a random suspension of talks. It's something that happens because someone in Pakistan, someone in the establishment there, decides that they don't want closer relations with India, and it's time to pull, it's time to hit the brakes on improvement.
And you're effectively describing what, you know, some analysts have called Pakistan's military jihadi complex, correct?
Yeah. And also, what I would say, I would also call it a foreign policy coup by the Pakistani military establishment.
Mm-hmm. And that's not really, you know, it's not an acute coup. It's something that's essentially been a facet of Pakistani politics for some time, you know, since the 1950s and Ayub Khan. And Yahya Khan and, you know, Zia-ul-Haq, Pervez Musharraf, we've seen several military strongmen exercise great power, and currently the Chief of Army Staff, Raheel Sharif, seems to be following in the footsteps of those men as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's widely known that the Nawaz Sharif government does not have control over defense matters. That's essentially run by the military.
And listen, you know, in the way of additional context, I should point out that before Bassett's comments last week leading to the suspension of the comprehensive dialogue, a Pakistani investigation team had arrived at Pathankot, at the Indian Air Force base there. And in sort of an unprecedented gesture, you know, India allowed an inter-services intelligence, the Pakistani External Intelligence Agency, to send an officer along with this team. And they visited, the visit essentially fell flat. It was supposed to help Pakistan in its investigation against Jaish-e-Mohammed. But essentially, after this team visited, India was looking for reciprocity. It was looking to send its own investigators to Pakistan to investigate Jaish-e-Mohammed's culpability in this attack. But Bassett, you know, essentially said that reciprocity wasn't part of this arrangement. And, you know, Akhi, I mean, to me that suggests an extent, because, you know, Bassett, he's part of the Foreign Service. He's a diplomat.
Yeah.
It suggests that there is, you know, maybe a little bit more of a linkage between the Foreign Service bureaucracy and the Pakistani military and the intelligence, who I absolutely agree with you, have no real interest of peace with India. Because you might even say, and many analysts have said, that the entire raison d'etre of Pakistan's military is its enmity with India.
Yeah. The interesting thing about that is would be interesting to know the instructions and the motives of the JIT team that Pakistan sent to India before they were sent. Was this actually a goodwill gesture on the part of Pakistan and Nawaz Sharif? And then upon arriving in India, and did they get instructions from the Pakistani military? And did they change their tone at that point? Or did they go to India with the explicit purpose of essentially trying to delegitimize India's concerns by having been instructed beforehand to come away and say, oh, we went to India and we were misled by the Indians and they fed us wrong information and so on and so forth. So it's either one of the two. This could have been pre-planned, or this could have been it could have been that upon their return, the Pakistani military vetted them or told them what to say we don't know. It's hard to say. This is Pakistan, of course. To be honest with you, in my opinion, I think Nawaz Sharif was generally trying to send a positive message to India, but I think the military sent a warning out and basically began writing the script at some point in the middle of this this entire visit. So they basically hijacked Nawaz Sharif's initiative.
Right. And, you know, I do also want to go back to the point that you made about this being unsurprising. Pessimism seems to always pay off for analysts in looking at peace between India and Pakistan. And as sad that it is, I mean, it is true if you look at the pattern, even, in the Modi era, since he came to power in May 2014. I mean, also another factor that we didn't really discuss is the fact that in late March, Pakistan claimed to have captured an Indian research and analysis wing, which is India's external intelligence agency spy in Balochistan. And, they produced a video in which this Indian national, India's government, by the way, owned up to the fact that this man is an Indian national. He was a former Indian naval officer, but they said that he definitely wasn't a spy. But anyways, the Pakistani establishment filmed him essentially confessing to working for RNAW, the Indian agency, which also, you know, led to additional tensions. And that is a very clear example of the Pakistani military taking the initiative and, releasing something like this at a time and when peace talks between the two countries were hanging by their sinews after the Pathankot attack.
Yeah, and so I guess to get back to one of the previous questions you had at the beginning, I don't think relations between India and Pakistan will improve markedly at any point, anytime soon, because as long as their military in Pakistan has a need to exist, and that need is, the need is fed by this, how they sell themselves as the only thing that can protect Pakistan against India, there's really no reason for them to like change their tune.
Absolutely. And, you know, this kind of is a good segue to the second part of this podcast on domestic politics. Did you want to say something else?
I do want to make a point about the military of Pakistan. We have been very critical for this entire segment about the military, but at the same time, it's like a catch-22, because the military is really, I think, the primary institution that holds Pakistan together. I mean, they do have some institutions here and there, but... for example, we know that no matter how bad terrorism gets in Pakistan, or the proliferation of multiple groups in the Punjab, or the Taliban seizing parts of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, Pakistan is never a danger of actually being overrun by any of these groups, because the military is the one institution that's so strong, that's so prevalent throughout the country, that it's really holding Pakistan together as at least a somewhat normal, semi-democratic state. Without the military, for all we know, Pakistan could be overrun fairly fast by a variety of militant groups. So it's really a catch-22. The military is what keeps Pakistan from becoming a normal state, but it's also what's preventing Pakistan from really going down a dark path that a neighboring country like Afghanistan has went down.
Yeah, I mean, there's the point that, you know, you can have a country that has an effective military that still holds the country together internally, but exercises, you know, civilian supremacy, and Pakistan has definitely struggled with that. And, you know, I think that, you know, there's a case to be made for the fact that Pakistan could one day see civilian supremacy over the military and still manage to ward off these internal threats. But, you know, that's, I think, a separate discussion about Pakistan's status as a state entity. But anyways, the point that I wanted to kind of take us towards is, you know, Modi, when he landed in Lahore on Christmas Day last year, he was staking out a considerable bit of political capital by making this huge, you know, gesture towards Pakistan and showing himself as an Indian leader who was really invested in peace. And obviously that's quite backfired now. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how the Indian side becomes increasingly constrained as well by, you know, Pakistan's quote-unquote perfidy, as you might describe it, after the Pathankot incident. So we'll definitely see that play out in the Indian press. We've already seen it since Bassett's comments. Several Indian commentators that I follow have noted that India shouldn't really be making these sorts of grand gestures towards Islamabad and should either ignore Pakistan entirely and focus on its own development, or wait until Pakistan shows a bona fide gesture of changing its use of, you know, subconventional warfare and terror groups against India.
Well, I mean, that last thing is not going to happen. So, I mean, it doesn't seem to me that if that's not going to happen, you can't just not talk to your neighbor. Like, there has to be at least some level of gesture. And, I mean, it's basically, we know India is going to make gesture after gesture and things aren't really going to change, but as long as they're making gestures, they're keeping channels of communication open, and I think that's what matters.
Yeah, and I think that's the counter-argument they hear often. And, you know, there's a middle ground, which is that India's political leadership, you know, the foreign minister, the prime minister, shouldn't really be involved. It should kind of be, they should really be handled at the level of bureaucrats, at the level of the foreign secretary, and the national security team. You know, they should be handling this. But, you know, that's a separate discussion. And I do want to kind of get to our discussion on Indian domestic politics for the second part of the podcast. So let me kind of, you know, provide some context here. And Aki, you wrote a great piece for us recently that I encourage listeners to read, explaining the importance of India's state elections. But essentially, India has a peculiar habit of near-perpetual electioneering across the country by national parties and regional parties alike. And this is largely thanks to its staggered state election schedule. Indian democracy is really in permanent election mode. So in May 2014, India had its national elections for the Lok Sabha, the lower house of the bicameral parliament of the country. And in that election, the BJP, Narendra Modi's center-right Hindu nationalist party, accomplished a feat that no party had managed since 1984. Namely, it acquired an outright majority and doesn't really need any coalition partners to rule in the Lok Sabha. However, the Rajya Sabha, the upper house of the bicameral parliament, there the legislators are indirectly elected by state legislatures, which gives India's states a level of salience that you might not see in other countries with bicameral parliaments. So the Modi government, while it did receive this historic mandate in the lower house, hasn't really been able to push its major reform agenda through because it hasn't managed to get the majority in the Rajya Sabha. And there is actually, the opposition Indian National Congress Party, the former ruling party of India, maintains a pretty strong position there and has allies with regional parties, giving it a fairly strong bulwark against the BJP's legislative plans. So Aki, there's four states that are either, have already gone to the polls or are currently going to polls, specifically Kerala, Assam, West Bengal, and Tamil Nadu. So do you just want to give us a quick walkthrough over, what the stakes are here and what the BJP should really be hoping for and what the likely outcomes are?
Yeah, sure. So the BJP's goal is to win as many state assemblies as possible, obviously, because that would help them get more votes into Rajya Sabha, and that was what Modi was really waiting for the last 2 years, because he really wanted to push the reforms once he secured the seats. But unfortunately, that's not going to happen. And what we're really seeing is, while initially the BJP was hoping to capitalize on the 2014 victory at the national level and expand its base from its northern and central base in India towards eastern and southern states, the only place they really seem to have a shot at winning this time around is the state of Assam. And that's really one of the big reasons they might win in Assam, is because immigration is a huge issue in Assam. Assam shares a border with Bangladesh, and there are a lot of immigrants who are coming into Bangladesh. And furthermore, there's a pretty large Muslim population in Assam. It's still a Hindu majority state, but the Muslim population in Assam is around 30%, and the proportion of Muslims to Hindus is increasing. There were riots between a Hindu ethnic group called Bodo in northwest Assam and Muslim immigrants a few years ago. And there have also been tensions against ethnic Assamese in the state itself and these mostly Bengali Muslim immigrants. Whether or not they're from Bangladesh or the citizens of India who happen to have a higher birth rate. But whenever you have these kinds of sectarian tensions, it's always good news for the BJP. Which is kind of unfortunate to say, because the BJP really came to power in India promising economic development and efficiency, improved lifestyle, really helping India's middle class like truly take its place in the globalized world. But this is not the platform they're winning on in Assam, the only state that they're probably going to win an election in. They're really campaigning on their Hindu nationalism. So that's what's putting them ahead in Assam.
Okay, and let me also, that point you just made about the BJP still relying on its Hindu nationalism, to me, it reminds me of the terrible result that they had in Bihar in November. Bihar was obviously an important state in the Rajya Sabha. It has 16 seats in the agency. For example, Assam only has 7 seats. So while, the BJP might have a strong showing there, once the results are tallied in mid-May, Bihar was, one of the crown jewels that the BJP really wanted to get in the Rajya Sabha, but they didn't. And a lot of the analysts that I've been reading on this, said that this was primarily due to the BJP's reliance on, sectarian politics, communalism, and, the party lost terribly to the Nitish Kumar three-party coalition. So Aki, do you think that the BJP learned its lessons in Bihar and is moderating its politics going forward, or really have we not seen any change and their kind of reliance on this, inter-religious tension is still present?
Yeah, so I think they'll use the inter-religious tension as a strategy when and where they think it's suitable for their purposes and where it helps them win elections. And obviously in Assam, it definitely works out in their favor. Because of all the tension that's been going on there. In a state like Kerala or in a state like West Bengal that are not seeing this level of inter-religious tension, then it doesn't help the BJP to essentially try to accentuate these tensions because it makes them look bad. It makes it look as though they're stroking these tensions to win, and they're neglecting their primary winning strategy in the national election, which is development. I believe West Bengal should have been a state that the BJP could have won had they planned it out a few years ago. Had Bihar not have happened, but they really threw away a good shot in West Bengal, because West Bengal has been ruled terribly the last few decades. First by the Communist Party, and then afterwards by the party that beat the communists, the Trinamool National Congress, and its leader Mamata Banerjee. And although Mamata Banerjee is personally very popular in West Bengal, her party is known for enormous corruption. And even though she promised that the governance of West Bengal would improve after defeating the communists, nothing has improved. In fact, if anything, at least the Communist Party of West Bengal was somewhat more sophisticated in exercising the leverage of government to use the machinery of the state to keep on winning. Whereas the Trinamool National Congress has acted in a very thug-like manner. A lot of intimidation, a lot of allegations of ballot rigging, a lot of allegations of corruption.
Akhil, let me ask you, that was a very good overview of the stakes in Assam and West Bengal, which I agree will be important for the BJP going forward, and the Rajya Sabha especially. Just as a closing note, I guess, for this episode of the podcast, and we'll have you back on, obviously, to talk more about sure. Modi's legacy and his neighborhood diplomacy. I want to do that sometime in May or June for the two-year anniversary of his inauguration. But I wanted to ask you, what is your overall assessment of, the BJP's now, soon to be 2 years in power, and the party's reform agenda? Have you been impressed? Have you been disappointed? What's your take?
I wouldn't say I'm completely disappointed, but obviously expectations are raised very high when they came to power in 2014, and the expectations have not been met. But that's also partially a function of the system in India. It really has nothing to do with the BJP. And I think Prime Minister Modi has done a good job. I think his traveling around the world has definitely been a very good marketing strategy for India. India had a lot smaller presence on the world stage when Manmohan Singh was prime minister. He didn't really push India the way Modi's pushing India. So definitely marketing is important. You need to market before you attract people to invest and build in your country. But you also need to create the economic reforms. So once they decide to invest in your country, they'll continue to invest in your country, and they'll expand more and more. And I mean, we don't see that happening just yet. Some minor changes in tax laws and whatnot have been made here and there. But, major legislation like the Goods and Service Taxes, GST, is still pending. At this point, Modi, I think, was waiting to have a favorable parliament to implement the changes he wanted to, and that's not going to happen. I think the big thing to see is if he's going to be able to compromise to push through the changes he wants in a diluted fashion, and if opposition parties will themselves even make the compromises, or if they really don't care about the future or the benefit of India, and they will refuse to compromise with the BJP, so it'll seem as though the BJP is incompetent and not able to develop India, which would definitely hurt their prospects in the 2020 elections.
Thanks, Aki. I think we'll find out, where things are going forward. Obviously, the BJP still has several years in power before the next Lok Sabha elections. But I want to thank you for your perspective. I also wonder, if India is slightly complacent by the fact that, right now, at least among the large emerging economies in the world, it is by and far heads and shoulders above all the other countries. The BRICS once were a cohesive group, and now India is really the only country that has its act together. China is obviously floundering. Russia and Brazil are in terrible circumstances. Brazil, along with South Africa, both their leaders are on the verge of impeachment and facing great strife there politically. So I wonder, I just hope that doesn't lead to too much complacence. So India does have its 7% plus growth rates. The IMF is obviously very bullish about that, but we'll see going forward. Anyways. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast and for sharing your perspective on these things.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And for our listeners, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And also, please do leave us a rating on iTunes. We really do appreciate that. Thanks a lot for listening.